You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And it's really a huge pleasure, an honor, a privilege for Brookings and for the Africa Growth Initiative and for Global to host the Nigerian Minister for Finance and Economic Coordination, Ngozi Ogonjo-Iweala, whom you all know. You all know even more now. You knew her from before. But the last few weeks, nobody's left who doesn't know her. And she emerged as an extremely strong candidate with, I think, in different political circumstances. Anyway, I don't want to say that, but not my job. But anyway, I think on behalf of all your friends, congratulations for the way you handled it in the name of all the developing countries and of Africa. This is your second time, of course, as Minister of Finance. Prior to the current appointment, Ngozi was the managing director of the World Bank from 2007 to 2011 and the first woman to hold this post. She had a 21-year career at the World Bank and also served as vice president corporate secretary of the bank. She has so many achievements to her credit. Given the limited time, I won't go through all of that. But I think one thing that she's particularly famous for in her own country and worldwide is for having introduced the practice of publishing each Nigeria's state monthly financial allocation from the federal government in the country's newspapers. The fight for transparency, for rigor, for growth, but also stability, I think Ngozi contributed to that in her own country in an amazing way. She was also instrumental in helping Nigeria obtain its first ever sovereign credit rating from Fitch and Standard & Poor's. She studied economics at Harvard and has her PhD from MIT. But she's also, you know, I talked a lot about Africa, and I think she is definitely one of the top African economic leaders. But she's also a world leader in her field. She's worldwide known. She got support from all over the world. And, of course, her long career in the World Bank has allowed her to build friendships from throughout all continents in the world. So she's both an African figure, an African leader, but also a world leader. And it really is a great pleasure to welcome her to talk about the challenges of development in 2012, in the world economy as we see it today. The things have changed a lot, but changing all the time. Every week, everybody has to re-edit their latest op-eds and their latest publications because there are always surprises. And we've learned that we're in an age of quite, you know, of strong volatility and unknowns that can hit us. I also very much would like to thank our own Mwangi Kimenyi, the director of the Africa Growth Initiative, who will engage in a conversation with the minister after her speech. Prior to joining Brookings, he was the founding executive director of the Kenya Institute for Public Policy Research and Analysis, KIPRA. He's one of the leading African economists. We are very privileged to have him here as a colleague at Brookings. His research focuses on Africa as a whole, but also in specifically on trade, regional integration, and U.S.-Africa relations. With that, I hand over the floor to you, Ngozi.
Welcome, Mal. Thank you very much for that introduction, and we've known each other for a long time. I was listening to you and say, wow, you know, Kamal is being really flattering here. You know, but I feel very grateful for everything that you said and for all the support that I got from all over the world. There was real euphoria in Africa in particular, you know, about the whole issue, and I think, you know, I don't think things will ever be the same again. But that is what I want to say. This talk is really about global challenges, and not only challenges of global governance, by the way. I see some wonderful friends in the crowd. Hi, Jean-Louis. How are you? Ambassador is here. Ambassador Adefuye, Your Excellency, thank you for coming. And the whole team from Nigeria, including our chief economic advisor, who is there, Professor Okidebe. I want to thank you, Mwangi. I feel so proud of Brookings and of this program. And I think it's grown from strength to strength, Kamal. So thank you very much. I'm sure Leo would also be quite proud of what is going on and the way you're taking it. So let me just say a few words about the challenges as I see them. I'm probably relating it to what I see are the challenges for policymaking on the African continent in particular, but, you know, generally, and those areas where we may need more help and advice, you know, from places like Brookings, international financial institutions, and so on. And we are very happy that maybe the Africa Growth Initiative could be involved in that kind of advice. The first thing I want to talk about is really what Kamal mentioned. I think what is really challenging for us now as policymakers is the uncertainty and volatility in the global environment. I think every day you wake up, you really do not know what sort of news you're going to get. You know, forecast growth rates for global and for certain parts of the world have been revised so many times. The IMF just revised its global growth forecast a little bit upwards, you know, just the past few days. It had revised it downwards for 2012 and 2013 from 3.6 down to 2.5 and 3.2, and now it's up again to 3.5%. So we are very happy to see that. But literally, every day you wake up, you know, things are changing. And on top of that, you know, we seem to also have a atmosphere of uncertainty in terms of other types of events, be they weather-related, climate change-related, etc. And I often like to quote this, that the World Bank had done a study that showed that in the 80s and 90s, there were about 180 crises per year. And now we're up to 360, which means that every day you wake up, there's a crisis of one sort or the other, be it financial, economic, physical, some kind of crisis somewhere in the world. And with the way the world is shrinking, you do not know how that will impact you, be it terrorism or some other event. And so with this kind of atmosphere, it's very challenging for policymakers, you know, to be able to be flexible in terms of the instruments they have to respond on the economic side. And, you know, to keep enough flexibility and cushions on the macroeconomic side to be able to take the economy to where it is needed. And, of course, there's this big debate on the side of the financial and economic crisis about austerity versus growth and how to get to growth and how to balance the two. And we are facing that as well. But the uncertainty in the economic, in the global environment, I think there are three or four areas where I think it's impacting, particularly many developing countries, including those in Africa. I think financing. It's funny, in some case senses, they say that there's quite a lot of liquidity sloshing around here in the U.S. But financing is more difficult to access, of course, you know, in the bond markets. Those countries in Africa who had begun to go to the capital markets to float bonds for the first time to help finance infrastructure and other investments. This is now very, very difficult. The risk premiums are high, the yields, this is something, an avenue that does not seem to be as open as it used to be. In fact, we in Nigeria are thinking of another bond issuance, but maybe this time tied to diaspora bonds. And we've had to hold back when we look at what the global environment is like. So that's one challenge, that at a time when there's a great deal of demand for investment, particularly in infrastructure to unleash growth, we are not able to access. And there's a lot of people are turning to domestic bond markets. And in one sense, this is good because it's deepening these markets. But on the other hand, we also have to be careful because the levels of domestic debt are increasing. And there seems to be a sense that if it's domestic, it doesn't matter. And we have to explain that sometimes if it's domestic, it could be worse. In the sense that, you know, there is no turning away from having to service these levels of debt. You cannot stop your own economy from going. And therefore, it's very important to look at domestic debt levels. So that's something I want to bring to your attention, because I think this is an area that we need to look at, particularly on the continent and so on. A second consequence of this is also that countries that are discovering where natural resources are being discovered now, like in East Africa, We were just at a meeting called by the ADB this morning when people were talking of, again, the euphoria there, the discoveries of oil and gas. But one consequence of the tightness of access to capital is you have lots of people selling debt. And in a way that might mortgage future receipts from these natural resources. And since we went through it during the time that Nigeria discovered the oil boom of the 70s, it is something to be alert, to be preemptive, with advice to these countries so that they don't go through the same. We have challenges in trade finance. According to international banks active in Africa, the supply for trade finance lines is 40% of pre-crisis levels. And obviously, you know, this is a very difficult issue as international banks remain risk averse. And this is impacting on trade as well. So the third issue on the global uncertainty is the demand for exports. We're still in many of the developing countries, but also in Africa, a very natural resource and primary export commodities driven. And if you look at, let's take my own country, for instance, 60 to 70% of our exports go to the OECD countries and to Europe and the US in particular. So that any slowdown in these economies has a direct consequence for us in terms of our economic growth and development and our ability to sell our goods. And this is the same for many other countries. So that's one area. A fourth issue to deal with the global uncertainty is that of food price volatility. And I want to mention this in particular because recent studies done by the World Bank has shown that, you know, the food prices have spiked again in 2011 back to the high levels they were in 2008. And of course, you know, the increase in prices of food has a direct impact on poverty, on nutrition levels, and on raising the levels of poverty, and therefore the extent to which countries in Africa, for instance, can attain the MDG 1 goal. So these are some of the things. I mean, people on the continent are trying to respond in various ways. As I said, one response to the financing crunch is looking for alternatives, including the domestic markets. On the one very good outcome on the agriculture and food side is that there's been a return, very serious look at how to diversify economies and with agriculture as a springboard. And I am very proud to say that in Nigeria, for instance, we are looking at agriculture completely differently as a business, the value chain approach, which we had never done before. I'm focusing on it from research to adaptation to production to transformation. And I think that that's the kind of approach that is needed. We spend about $10 billion a year on food imports with four commodities, rice, wheat, I think fish, and what's the fourth one? Sugar. Those are the four big imports that we have. And there's absolutely no reason why we can't grow all of those except for wheat. Where we don't have any comparative advantage, but we can substitute cassava flour for wheat flour, and that's what we are doing. But this whole atmosphere of uncertainty about food prices is also pushing us into a whole new direction and look on agriculture, and it's the biggest job creator. I'll come to that in a minute. So that's been a good thing. If you look all over the continent, agriculture as a business is being looked at more and more. When I say it, agriculture as a business, some people might take exception. I'm not talking about moving away from smallholder farmers to large farms. I'm talking about turning the smallholder into a more business-oriented enterprise and also accommodating where you can, both commercial farming along with subsistence. So these are a couple of ways. On the fiscal side, you know, I'm very proud of many of our governments in Africa because they've really stuck to very, I would say, responsible policy responses in terms of managing the economy. If you look at all the aggregates, people are struggling to manage inflation. The exchange rate, you know, people are struggling to make sure we don't creep into an era of overvaluation. People are trying to be responsible fiscally in a way that we've never seen before. So both their fiscal instruments and monetary policy are working in tandem to ensure continued macro stability as a platform for launching growth in many of the countries. And I think that this success, relative success, has led to Africa rebounding faster from the crisis than it would have. There's usually a one-year lag, you know, in the way that Africa comes back after this crisis. But this time we've rebounded faster. And in fact, growth on the continent is forecast to reach 5% and better than that, which compared to what is happening elsewhere, is a very good response. The new crop of policymakers realize that they have to keep responsible macroeconomic policies in place if we are to be able to manage the present crisis. I think the problem is the fear that there won't be enough fiscal space. Should we really have another shock? Because during the 2008 crisis, whatever buffers were created are now much lower and not as available. I can even cite Nigeria as an example of that. So if there's another big shock in the system, I'm not sure that we'll have the buffers to be able to handle it as well. But for now, I am very encouraged by what I see in terms of both monetary and fiscal policy in many of our countries. So let me go quickly from the uncertainty in the global environment to a few other challenges, that global challenges that we see. One, of course, is the challenge of job creation. And I think I've talked a lot about this. I think that my personal opinion, the single most important challenge facing the globe at the moment is that of job creation. Unemployment rates are high everywhere. You know, in the Eurozone at 10.8%, unprecedented levels of unemployment. Here in the US, about 8.2%. Spain is above 23% now. South Africa, 24%. Nigeria, 23%. And I could go on and on. So this is not a challenge for one place in the world, but all over. And I think that if we look at youth unemployment and then underemployment, the picture is even bleaker. And I like to talk about youth unemployment because, you know, we've seen the consequences of not taking advantage, you know, of our youth and getting the demographic dividend that we should out of them. When you have that kind of situation, you can see what happened in the Arab Spring. It was about governance, but it was also about dignity and having jobs and being able to sustain yourself. So I think this is something in country after country that we need to pay particular attention to. I mean, youth unemployment in my country is above 30%, and underemployment is a significant issue. And I know that in most of the African countries, this is a very key issue. In France, also, huge unemployment numbers. So the focus, key focus that I think we need to give is creating jobs and creating jobs for youth. And I think that this is a challenge that the international financial institutions should really focus on big time. I know that the World Bank is doing a World Development Report. The next one is on jobs. But within our countries, what we are looking for is creative and innovative ideas, you know, to push. And they're, right now, they are not in great supply. So I'm also challenging CGD, Brookings, and all these areas. Of course, we are looking at fundamentally what are the long-term responses within the economy. You know, we are seeing growth in Nigeria. We grew at 7.32% last year. But it is not a growth that is creating jobs. It's not a growth that is inclusive enough. And so we've got to look at the underlying sources of growth that could create jobs, like agriculture. That's why it's so popular, housing and construction sector, and try to develop those in the long term. And then in the short term, we need instruments that are creative. We started one program, which is very popular at home, called YouWin, Youth Enterprise with Innovation, which seeks to support young entrepreneurs with mentoring, advice, and access to credit in order to create jobs. And we launched this competition, and it's all totally on merit online. You know, 24,000 youths applied. We were able to weed them down to 6,000 with the help of DFID, the World Bank, Lagos Pan-African University Business School, and also Plymouth Business School in the UK provided quality assurance. And 24,000, including 500 youths from the diaspora, located here in the US and the UK, applied for this. And with 6,000 were selected based on certain criteria for training, mentoring. These are people, I met many of them. Some have small businesses with 7 people and they think they can triple it to 21 if they have the nice, the kind of support needed. Some are succeeding but don't know how to manage success. They don't have the skills. Some are seeking access to credit. So we're able to weed this down to 6,000 and then eventually to 1,200 winners who are getting grants from $10,000 to $100,000 to support their businesses, access to credit, they are registered with banks, mentoring from some of the key entrepreneurs in the economy to support them to grow. And we're expecting to create 80,000 to 110,000 jobs from this over the next 3 years. And it's tremendously exciting to be able to support this. So it's programs like this that we are looking to, you know, different ways of engaging our youth. Of course, one ulterior motive that I have as finance minister is all those who were trained, we registered, we brought forward a special desk in the, of the business registration unit and had them all registered without telling them we're increasing the tax base. So this is a little secret enterprise that I have going at the same time. So I just wanted to give that as, and what we are seeking as a response to this are what are these kind of creative ideas? How do we become more inclusive? What types of jobs are we trying to create for our youth? Very quickly, let me move on to some other challenges. Well, I mean, linked to the issue of job creation is, of course, the huge issue of infrastructure. If you, a recent poll done by the World Bank of businesses in my country showed that 53% say that the single most important problem they face is infrastructure deficit. And of infrastructure, power is the biggest one. And I think in many countries, in Africa, we need about $120 billion a year. And the current gap, after you've taken account of all sources of financing, is $50 billion to take care of the infrastructure needs. That's huge. I was in India recently. They are looking for about $1 trillion over the next 5 years for infrastructure finance. And so, you know, obviously these large sums of money are not easily available. Or there's liquidity, but it's not going or being captured where it's needed and invested. You know, so we've been turning to alternative instruments. Everybody talks of PPPs. But one depressing fact I found about PPPs recently is that in the past decade in Africa, only 17% of PPP arrangements have closed. 17%. And each one has taken on, it takes on average 7 years. At that rate, you know, PPPs are not the most viable instrument to close this financing gap. You know, so we really have to look at what is wrong. If everybody is touting them as the savior for bringing in additional financing, but with these kinds of records, you know, it's not very promising. So we need to look at more innovative approaches. We need to find out what is wrong and why it's taking so long. And I do think a big challenge for the international financial institutions is in this, in trying to use their instruments to help leverage additional resources from the private sector in a more creative way. And, of course, trying to support PPPs, but in a faster more impactful way than now. I know, for instance, on the continent, we have tremendous resources available in pension funds, which can be leveraged to be invested in infrastructure. And I'm not quite sure why they are not being. Let me take Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa alone. In Nigeria, we have about $15.3 billion. We just started the defined contribution system a few years ago as supposed to define benefits. And already we have about $15 billion. Kenya has about $5.6 billion. And South Africa about $188.5 billion in pension funds that could be reinvested if we could find a clever way. So again, on the continent, it's not that resources are not there, but the resources are not being leveraged and invested in ways that could materially help fund infrastructure. So this is a challenge again for those who are applying their minds to this. Quickly, I mean, another set of issues we are dealing with, global challenge, is social sector issues. But I just want to say two quick points on this one because we are all familiar. The first is that in the area of education, we are dealing with the need for skills. So it's not an issue of just education, looking at primary, secondary, or tertiary. Tertiary, by the way, is really suffering on the African continent and needs serious investment. But even the products that are coming out of these do not have the skills that are marketable in the workplace. And so devising a system that can produce the right kind of skills, focusing intently on vocational training, is very, very serious. Where I think somehow there's an attention deficit on that issue from the international community. And of course, we have examples of countries that have done this successfully, like Korea that we could learn from, like Germany, Switzerland. All these places have very strong vocational training and education programs that can help us put the kind of marketable skills for artisans, for entrepreneurs, for engineers that are needed. So that's the focus, I think. On the education sector, I just want to say that the rise of non-communicable diseases are really impacting on productivity in many countries. I know we are focusing in many developing countries, Africa in particular, on malaria and HIV/AIDS, and that's very good and we shouldn't lose that. But let us also know that there's a rising epidemic of non-communicable diseases, and we really need to focus on building our health systems to deal with this. And I think this is a challenge for the World Bank because we've got all the vertical funds that are dealing with the other diseases. Quickly, another challenge is that of dealing with fragility, security issues, terror, and the impact of this on economic development. Just this year, you know, Nigeria has experienced, for instance, a number of incidents that you know of the Boko Haram. And we need to get a handle on these kinds of incidents. If we don't secure, I'm saying the obvious, but without the kind of security, you cannot really pursue development. So you need to have a very important approach to this. Internationally, we need to have an exchange of skills in how to dealing with these situations and attacks from one country to the other. And in Nigeria, we have, of course, been able now to access help from the US, the UK, and France in particular. But these issues that lead to violence and fragility, the World Bank has done a seminal report on fragile states, and I really commend some of the findings to that on improving justice, security, institutions, and governance in these countries, and above all, in creating jobs as a way of dealing with these fragility issues. Global public goods, of course, the focus on green growth, I think, is another global challenge. And soon we'll have the Rio plus 20. We know that for the past 250 years, economic growth has been achieved largely at the expense of the environment. And that studies show that by 2008, about 25% of the world's land surface had been degraded. So this is not a luxury. I mean, this is when we talk about greening growth and dealing with issues of climate change, this is something that has to be done. You know, but how? I think that some of the approaches to greening growth are things that are staring us in the face. You know, correcting market failures and dealing with inefficiencies in the way that growth happens. You know, take even the issue of subsidies on oil. You know, if you can have smart and well-targeted subsidies focused away from subsidizing fossil fuels, this is a way of greening growth. The kind of growth and support engendered by these subsidies is not smart. So both in terms of fiscal issues as well as in terms of environmental issues, you really kill so many bullets, so many problems with one bullet when you work on these kind of types of subsidies. And you know that we started in Nigeria, we tried to a very difficult situation, but we managed to phase out at least 49% of the subsidies after 5 years of no government daring to touch it in the country. But now, with the rising price of oil, this has scaled back again to about 35%. It's been eroded. But I'm just saying that's one example of, you know, how you can green growth. Greening growth is not an esoteric thing. There are many, many policies today that are not smart and are inimical to climate change that you can correct and make it work for you at the same time. Finally, let me touch on quickly on a couple of other issues. Gender. Very, very keen. I don't need to go into all of that. As far as I'm concerned, this should be a central global issue just because of all the economics and all the economic work that has been done to show that a focus on gender in an empowerment of girls and women in the workplace, has such an impact on GDP growth, on inclusive growth, on moving our economies forward in so many areas. And there are all the examples. We are running out of time, so I won't give them to you, of what happens when you integrate the gender approach into the way you do development. This is a global issue that we need to push more on because it's a win-win. And I think the issue that confronts us as policymakers is, what exactly does this mean on a day-to-day basis when you're trying to do policy? We are trying one approach in Nigeria to try and integrate gender, mainstream gender. We've started with the Minister of Agriculture, who is very forward-looking, and the Minister of Women's Affairs, to have an MOU between them, spelling out how exactly girls and women will be empowered within the context of the new agricultural programs. How will women get jobs? How will girls be impacted? So we are trying that. If this works well and succeeds, we will try with the other ministries to have specific agreements and MOUs, and we will put more budget behind them as an incentive to make this survive. So we have to find specific ways of giving voice to some of the issues that we believe in. Finally, let me just say quickly on institutions. This is something that is long-term, but it's still a challenge for many of our countries. And I say it because I think places like the World Bank, this is the non-sexy part of doing development that is also not that easily measured, but it has to be done. Someone has to stay with issues of institution building and governance in many of our countries for a long-term impact. And finally, on aid flows, we've seen that rising aid flows over the past decade. But recent studies by the bank also show that aid flows are falling in real terms and in real per capita terms as well. Now, the reason I want to say a word on that is because I think that this may not just be a temporary phenomenon that is due to the tight fiscal situation in many of the donor countries. I think this is something to watch, that this episode of difficulty in the Eurozone and the OECD countries may well give the excuse for scaling back on aid going forward. So I do not believe that either the soft loan credit arm of the World Bank will find it as easy going forward to raise the kind of resources that we raised last time when I chaired it, $49.3 billion. Very impressive in an era of very difficult fiscal situation for countries and fiscal consolidation. So I think we need to think it through about aid. And I'm not sanguine that if growth were to return to these countries, we would see a similar return in the levels of aid that is being given. What does this mean? Countries have to look hard at domestic resource mobilization. And if you look at tax to GDP ratios, in many of our countries, there's still a long way to go and in the ability to raise those. And I would really urge both think tanks and the IFIs that real assistance in tax policy and tax administration is still a very crucial, it's not very exciting, but it's really very important part of the way we do business. And I don't think there's enough attention being paid to that and enough help that is available. So that's one area I wanted to find out. And then finally, a good area that is emerging is globally a good trend is that of increasing South-South interaction, investment, and sharing of knowledge. I think this needs to be developed as an instrument. I can tell you that most of the investments now in developing countries are from other developing countries. Even within Africa, as we were looking the other time, we found that there's more investment in African countries from other African countries, principally Nigeria and South Africa, in many African countries, than from elsewhere. And so how do we encourage this South-South investment and trade? How do we encourage the sharing of knowledge between southern emerging market countries and other emerging market countries? I think this is an area that is very exciting. Again, I started at the World Bank an initiative on the South-South Knowledge Exchange with other colleagues. And I think it's one of the most exciting instruments that we have and one where we need to push forward to make a more intermediary role that can really assist countries to benefit from each other. So, and by the way, South-North knowledge is not excluded. There are many interesting innovations now happening in the South that could help northern countries. I think that, you know, if Greece had done some of the structural reforms and reforms of its social security system, you know, that many of the developing countries have now done, I think it would have benefited much more. So a bit of South-North knowledge in that direction would be very helpful. Well, let me stop there, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you.
Thank you very much. I think I'm already wired. Thank you very much, Honorable Minister. This is a very special day for AGI. Many of you may not know, but AGI would not be here if it were not for the Honorable Minister. She was a distinguished fellow here at Brookings, what they call the Ministerial Fellow. And it's because of her presence here and discussions that Brookings decided to start an African unit. And so that so this is sort of your baby here, so we are very happy. This is one of the outcomes. So I thank you very much, also for highlighting most of these challenges, global challenges that we are actually dealing with. I think as AGI, we didn't focus on those issues, on not just the global governance, but food security issues. That you have all these issues that you have outlined, and we hope that we can provide some answers to the African governments and beyond. So before I open up for questions, I would like to ask the minister to make a few comments. One that you just talked about last, when you talk about South-South, which is the role of China in Africa? How we see China? There are a lot of questions whether we, you know, how are we engaging China? Some of people are saying China is doing very well, so we would like to see how do you feel about China's role in Africa and how could we effectively engage China? And the other issue that I like maybe you could highlight briefly is on we seem to, as Africa, we have moved on to fast-track regional integration, and we expect at least the last heads of state meeting in January concluded sort of that we want a continental free trade area in 2017. How do you see this, and you know, how do you think that we are making progress on those areas?
Okay.
And before, again, she answers, I would like to remind our viewers, there are people watching us, that you can follow us on Twitter, and it's hashtag AGI Ngozi, AGINGOZI. Thank you.
Thank you, Mwangi, very much. You know, China's role in Africa always comes up, and I'm sure there have been many seminars and many PhD theses written on this. And, you know, if you look at the numbers I mentioned for the requirements we have just for infrastructure finance, not to talk of the other needs, you know that Africa has to look for as many diverse sources of financing as it possibly can. And so I often say to people that there's absolutely nothing wrong, you know, with seeking Chinese finance for projects in Africa. I think it is the kind of the approach and the underlying agreements for the use of this finance that we have to be very careful about, so we don't recreate situations that are not transparent for our people to know exactly what that finance is being used for, and which will come to haunt policymakers later. I think many countries have learned lessons, but I'm not sanguine that we have learned it all, you know. And of course, there are a lot of deals there could be. There could be, let me put it that way. Deals that, you know, not because, sometimes it's not because leaders are being dishonest, but just because there's tremendous asymmetry of information when some of these deals are being arranged with a great deal of knowledge on the side of those who are, when it's a mineral deal, who are coming to exploit the resource and in the legal agreements that are made. And then sometimes it's just outright poor governance issues and corruption that may be involved. So we need to watch out. But that could happen with any country's finances, although people seem to be push, what about the Chinese? What about the Chinese? So I think also the Chinese, it's not all only about grabbing mineral resources. They really have, you know, much more, I think, broader objectives on the continent than people would like to think, you know. And I think that we need to be very smart about the way we assess assess Chinese intervention on the continent. But I had the pleasure of being invited last year to address the Chinese Mining Association. And in China, you know, I came in thinking this is a meeting, Chinese Mining Association, where maybe there'll be 500 or 600 people in the room. There were 4,000. And the meeting was chaired by Li Keqiang, who is going to be the next, hopefully, the next, one of the next prime minister, next leader. So it was really high level. And I gave them a very simple lecture, mapping out 4 or 5 principles for investment in Africa. One of which was, you know, I wouldn't bore you with all of it, but very clearly, one having to do with bringing the communities they are working in, if it's all about natural resource exploitation, watching, being open and transparent about the kinds of agreements they enter into. Because these natural resources, once you invest in them, you cannot carry them away as such. They are there. So if you're not clear that the population knows what you're doing, you know, you may rue it, rue that in the future. But in a nutshell, I think the Chinese investment is one alternative that we should explore. And we should not let go of in Africa. We should do it responsibly. And we should be very clear and open about the types of agreements we enter into. By the way, I was took a delegation to China from Nigeria recently. And many African finance ministers are making tracks to China. But I think we are wiser now about the way we do it. Then on the issue of regional integration, I really think that this is one of the, if we talk about the challenges that are facing the globe, we also talk about challenges that are current and facing Africa. This, if we don't get a handle on regional integration, and if the international financial institutions don't develop the instruments, they still do not have instruments for assisting with lending and so on regional integration. I think this is some area that needs, you know, so the idea of a continental free trade zone, the idea of greater integration is a good one. We should do it. Intra-African trade is very important, particularly in things like food. You'll find that a country next door or even within the same country, it's not a question of a food deficit overall. It's a question of distribution of food, and it doesn't happen because the integration is not there, the transport routes are not there, and the bureaucratic obstacles on the way of moving things are so many. So I'll become more convinced about a continental free trade area the integration when our governments begin to remove these obstacles one by one. And when there's faster progress on that, you know, then I'll be a big believer. But I think that's the direction in which we ought to push.
Very good. Thank you. I'm going to take 3 questions at a time, but please make them very brief You get a microphone, so don't make a speech. A comment, maybe very quick, and a question. Then we go on. So the gentleman over there, please, a quick one.
Hi, Honorable Minister. My name is Ibe Abu Chichukuma. My family is from Anambra State. I read an article in Washington Post that you mentioned something about Nigeria not having enough of tax experts. It was in relation to, that was an article posted about you and Washington Post just a few days ago. So my question is, in terms of human capacity management in regards to some of these areas, in terms of tax experts, what is your administration doing? For example, here in US, they have something like management fellows to bring in perhaps highly specialized students or young professionals to enter public service and do at least 2 years or enter the public service because they bring specialized skills. Second question, when you talked about infrastructure, could you speak more about regional effort, for example, West African gas pipeline, as a way to have access to regional infrastructure, since finance is a big issue? Can the regional, can there be a regional cooperation to build infrastructure in the continent? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take two more and make them brief. That gentleman just there.
Yeah, Honorable Minister, my name is Joseph Asike. I listened to the challenges, you know, you presented facing developing nations. Your experience at the World Bank and your first tenure as finance minister in Nigeria, and the second tenure as coordinating minister and finance minister in Nigeria. Don't you think you have the experience, the expertise? If you look at China, India, Brazil, the emerging economies, in Africa, we think about Nigeria, probably in South Africa. Your expertise and experience would have been better served if you insisted on doing what you know best for that region instead of the distraction of World Bank presidency.
Okay, let's go. Let's be very, very specific on questions. And may I make an announcement that we just received a note. The minister is supposed to be leading a session on G24, and it's been moved. So instead of 3:45, we are going to go up to 3:40.
Oh,
so make them even more brief. Could you answer those fast?
Okay.
Yeah. So the last one is a bit fake to me. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
For the, on the issue of the tax experts, I think I was very, it's amazing. I don't see most of the articles that are written about me, to be honest. I hardly have the time to read newspaper, so I haven't seen it. When I was speaking, I was referring about very special expertise, oil, tax, experts. You know, they're very scarce all over the world. You know, we've just managed to find a young Nigerian working in Liberia who is specialized in this area, and he's agreed to come home. It's an area where people are often looking. And right now, I feel that tax people, lawyers, specialized in these kinds of agreements are in very scarce supply. And that is what leads, and again, I come back to the asymmetry of information issue. When you are negotiating these agreements and you don't have the proper expertise, you often end up in situations where the agreements are not very favorable to the country involved. And in Nigeria, involved now in the PIB, Petroleum Industries Bill, and we need these kinds of people. So yes, we are looking for ways and means. Your idea of having this kind of fellowship and so on, these are some of the things we can explore for bringing our people home. But I tell you, it's a very specialized area, you know, that I'm talking about. So if you know of young people who are, specialized in the area of oil and gas and natural resource sort of tax issues, I'd be very pleased to meet them. On infrastructure, yes, I agree that regional efforts are very important. And I think that The African countries have in fact identified under working with the G20 some specific mm-hmm. regional infrastructure programs that will be very beneficial to the continent. So there's an effort going on. I think the key issue is that financing even to do the feasibility studies is a problem. You have to program about 10% of the cost of any of these projects. You know, and it amazes me. I think we are looking at the third Inga or something like that. And 100 million will be needed. Not the big Inga, not the 40 billion. The much smaller one that would cost about 5 billion or 6 billion. To even get on a regional basis the 100 million or so needed to do the feasibility study becomes a problem. And this is where I think that the regional, international financial institutions should deal with this, should develop instruments, you know, that can help unlock this and begin to push us on the way. The countries themselves should deal with it. You know, so I don't want to put it on to the International Financial Institute, but you find that things really get stuck. So we need that kind of thing. And the West African Gas Pipeline is a good effort. It took some doing, but at least it's working now. Finally, on this issue of, was it a distraction to be looking at the world? But, well, thank you for thinking that my expertise is well needed on the continent and at home. I humbly say thank you for that. And I obviously went home to deploy it. But I think when your continent, you should know the origin of my participation. I've explained it. Was not that Okonjo-Iweala was planning to contest for the World Bank. If I were, I would never have packed up to go home to start being a finance minister again. It just doesn't make any sense to go there for a few and then, you know, I mean, I'm not that crazy to be moving back and forth like that. You know, I speak very bluntly, so permit me. But, you know, when leaders on the continent felt that they wanted me to contest and they phoned my president, they didn't phone me, and he had a lot of pressure put on him by the head of the AU, ECOWAS, President Ouattara, President Zuma of SADC, who said they wanted an African to contest this post, and they thought I was the one. I don't think it's a distraction when your whole continent says, go and serve. So it was not easy for me, but I think I had the courage to say, okay, you know, if they want us to look and show that Africa has the capacity to manage this and to open the door, why should we Africans then be talking about distractions? You know, so sometimes in my country, I saw a couple of articles of people, you know, let's not beat ourselves over the head. Let us take pride. When our leaders, this is an unprecedented time when African governments hung together in great unity. And so we should applaud it and not talk about distraction. Sorry.
Okay. Gentlemen here, I'll take two more maybe. And again, be brief. Then we release the minister in time.
Thank you very much, Honorable Coordinating Minister of Finance. My name is Adeshina Salau. I'm a lawyer in law and development, and I live in Abuja, Nigeria. While you're talking of the challenges, corruption was mentioned in passing while you're addressing the issue of China. My contribution is not about talking so much about corruption today, but the process of corruption, particularly in funding agriculture. Under the FCPA, you have companies from the north that go to Africa to invest, and they get involved in corruption. And we all know that one of the evils of corruption is that it inflated the cost of projects abroad. So when the fines are paid to their countries, $20 million, $24 million. My appeal to GDI is to look for opportunities as a think tank to raise the issues of having to return some of these fines back to Africa and can be invested in agriculture. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Any other?
Yes, I think we need a non-Nigerian.
Thank you very much for the very informative talk. You mentioned the fact that there is, in Nigeria and across the world, there's greater economic growth, but still a lot of unemployment. Mm-hmm. And to me, factors like this and the financial crisis are more symptoms of a greater cause. And there's growing consensus that our economic system is fundamentally unsustainable. I would like to get your opinion on the move, for example, movements such as the Movement for a New Economy, such as Bhutan's push to integrate the concepts of gross national happiness in our economic frameworks, and the fact, your opinion on what you think about that.
Okay.
Happiness. One more. Here, the lady right here, please.
Yes, thank you very much. You mentioned this idea that we need to have more vocational training, and it's really a cultural shift that, frankly, much of the developing world really has to embrace. How do you, or have you thought of, sort of how do you get to people's social attitudes about education to say that actually we need more plumbers, we need more of these kinds of trainings, which, frankly, for many traditional societies have not valued for so many years?
Okay.
Very good. The Honorable Ambassador has told me that's the last question, so we'll see.
Okay. All right, let me also try to be brief in my answers. I think, you know, the observation that our economic system as we know it, if we do not change, particularly in integrating concerns about climate change and the sustainability of the way development works vis-a-vis the environment, that we will have a continuously unsustainable. I agree with that very much. You know, when you begin to look at the impact of climate change now, I don't really know why people still debate, because it's manifesting in so many ways. So yes, our economic system needs to find a way to still grow in a way that maintains the environment. I think the debate and the fear of developing countries is that for this past 200 years or so, or 250 years, this pattern of growth and has been set in place by the more developed countries, and they've managed to get now to a living height of living standards for their population, you know, that is very comfortable, barring these episodes, these business cycles and episodes of crisis. And the developing countries fear that, you know, the insistence on finding a new path is on the back of their growth. So I think what we need to do is a lot of convincing that you can both grow and be green, if you want to put it that way. But the level of information and knowledge about how to do this sustainability is really low. I'm telling you now, if there's one gaping hole in terms of knowledge in many of our countries on the African continent, is on the issue of green growth. Policymakers are not as aware. It's not. It's something you talk about and then you just sort of say it on the side. It has not been, sort of implanted in the psyche of how you do policy. So I really think there's a challenge here in getting people to understand what this is and evolving a new model of sustainable growth. On the issue of the gross national happiness, I was in Bhutan and met with all the policymakers and the king. This was while I was still managing director at the World Bank. And I'm all for measures that just do not depend on income alone. And we all know that GDP, whilst very important, is an approximate measure of how well we are doing. And it's not the only one. I certainly welcome any additional work. I think Stiglitz and some others have taken these concepts, you know, to a different level. But I don't know what has become of that work. I would certainly be interested. Finally, on the vocational, so true. There's a cultural shift that is needed. And I think the way that I don't know how we got into these education systems. They're very elitist in approach. If you come to Nigeria, one of the biggest gaps is in getting these artisans. So we have to go to Cote d'Ivoire and Benin and Togo to import plumbers and carpenters, good carpenters. Well, carpentry, I think we're relatively good. But plumbers and electricians and all those trades, if you want to build, if you try building a house and using the local talent on this, you really see a big gap. So, but there's a psychology that going to school means a white collar job. So we need to change that. We need to, but how do you do it? I think the incentive system has to be changed, whereby people who go into this vocation are paid much more, as they are in many places, and we're seen as a really sustainable means of livelihood, so that the desire to go into white-collar jobs is diminished. So that's what's going to bring the cultural shift when we incentivize these vocations much more. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We are going to close, and I have no words but to thank you very much for this participation. We are very proud of you.
Thank you.
As AGI, as Brookings, as Africa, and the courage that you have taken. When we started to organize this, it had nothing to do with the World Bank.
Yes.
But it was to do, we were very interested to see the courage you had taken on removing the subsidies and dealing with other economic issues in Nigeria. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you.
Here at Brookings.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much.